You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Morgan Housel back to the podcast. Morgan is a partner at Collaborative Fund. He is a two-time winner of the Best in Business Award from the Society of American Business Editors and Writers, winner of the New York Times Sydney Award, and a two-time finalist for the Gerald Loeb Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism. He has a new book. It's called The Art of Spending Money, Simple Choices for a Richer Life. And you're going to really enjoy the pod. Morgan, welcome to the pod.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me back.
In your author's note that begins the book, you write, quote, "Money is less about numbers and more about stories. Stories we tell ourselves about what matters, what makes us happy, and how we measure success. Spending money is more art than science," end quote. That assertion, I suspect, will confuse many business people, but not business people who also work in the arts. So I get it.
You know, I could have called this book The Science of Spending Money, but I didn't, right? Because I don't think that exists. I don't think there's a science of spending money. Everybody is so different. We're all products of different backgrounds and different generations and different family dynamics. And it's an art. And art means that it's individual. What works for me might not work for you. It can mean it's contradictory. It can mean it changes throughout the course of your life. It's a much messier field than we want to think exists. Everybody wants just a formula. Here's a formula for how to do it. Plug it into your own life. Live a happy life. It just doesn't work that way. And so rather than this being a science and me giving you advice on how to do it, it's stories about the psychology of how people think about spending and greed and envy and jealousy and social aspiration, trying to dig into it from that angle.
It was really interesting, the sequence of books I had to read for the podcast, because my last one that I read and interviewed was Richard Thaler, who was updating a book he wrote 40 years ago about how psychology ended up affecting economics at the university level, and that it wasn't rational, right? What we quote unquote we call rational is not necessarily operating in economic philosophy. So it seems to me a very similar sort of world that you guys are waters that you're both swimming in.
I think that's right. And there's a distinction too between if I look at you and I say, oh, the way you spend your money is not rational. It actually might be rational for you, but not for me. And mm-hmm. So it's always in the eye of the beholder. I think that's true for a lot of things in finance, whether it's investing or how you make money, how you spend money, how you save money. Most debates are actually, they're not people disagreeing with each other. It's just people who are very different talking over each other. And people understand that if we're talking about our taste in music, or our taste in food, our taste in movies. People understand that's subjective and what works for you might not work for me, no problem. But with money, they want to think of it as a science. They want to think of it as this should be 2 + 2 = 4. There should be an answer that works for everybody. And I think that's the flaw for a lot of things in finance, is people thinking that it's more scientific than it is.
You have a line in this book that it, and I think this has been true in everything I've read that you've done. You have a way of just saying something that is, I've said this line to other people. It's very powerful. You say, quote, "All behavior makes sense with enough information." That is a mic drop. Did you know that was a mic drop when you wrote that?
Well, I wrote this in the book. I got that from my brother-in-law, who's a social worker. And
wow.
He says that's a common phrase in social work when you are mm-hmm. dealing with a child whose behavior is atrocious. They're mm-hmm. not going to school. They're getting into fights. They're doing drugs, whatever it might be. All behavior makes sense with enough information. If you dig into that child's life and see what they're dealing with at home, you understand it a little bit. You don't justify it. You don't say it's fine, but you understand why they're doing it. All behavior makes sense with enough information. And I think that is true, not just in social work, but it's true for uh-huh. every aspect of life, including how we spend money. I often think, you know, if you see a middle-aged man driving a yellow Lamborghini, There's a story there. There's a very powerful story of who they're trying to impress, what they value and whatnot. And the story can be different for everyone. It's not always judgmental, but there's a story there. If you see a billionaire driving a Ford pickup truck, there's a story there. You know, those are extreme examples, but how we spend and who we're trying to signal for, what we value or whatnot, there's always some story there where all behavior makes sense with enough information. True for me, true for you. Everyone is some level of that.
You've been writing about money for what, like 2 decades or so?
Yep.
How was your relationship to the ideas that ended up in this book? Thinking back 2 decades ago, was this always the foundation, the way you thought about this, or has it evolved?
Oh, not even close.
Oh, really?
It's always ongoing, too. I think everything I've ever written has started with self-reflection of, like, what is this problem in my life? What is this, you know, how do I think about envy and jealousy? Who am I envious of, and why is that? Trying to dig into it. And what's true is that 20 years ago, you know, when I was just getting out of college and just starting my life, what's true for me as a 22-year-old, my desire to have a yellow Lamborghini and a Rolex and Gucci sunglasses was off the charts. And I think the reason why is because I had nothing else to offer the world. I had no intelligence. I had no humor. I didn't know how to love people. I didn't have anything else to offer. And so the last remaining lever in my head was, maybe they'll be impressed with my car, because I got nothing else to offer the world. But I think if you are smart, and you can add value, and you can love other people, and you're funny, and you have all these other skills, then your desire to say, hey, look at my watch, isn't that cool, falls quite a bit. Now, that's not black and white. There are plenty of people who are funny and intelligent and also have nice cars and nice houses, etc. But I think for a lot of people, their desire to show off materially is making up for the fact that they can't gain their attention and admiration through other aspects of their life that are more durable. And I think this is not black and white. So if you know people for who this doesn't fall for, I get it. But if you have a great spouse and a great career and kids who admire you and good health and a good set of friends, most, not all, but most of those people do not have a strong desire for strangers to be impressed with their car or their house or their clothes or their jewelry. And I think that tends to be true. And that was definitely me 20 years ago, that my desire to show off materially was the inverse of what else I had to offer the world.
So when you read a book like this, you start to think about your own spending and that sort of thing. And, you know, we're empty nesters now, you know, so we're not paying for college or any of that stuff. And I was kind of doing an inventory on what I spend money on. And it's like, we both have cars that are paid off that aren't flashy. We don't care about cars. I like to have different chucks. So I've got my like tennis shoes. So I've got like 6 or 7 different pairs of those, because I like those. I like good food. I like good wine. I don't need a Rolex, though. My wife did just get me an Apple Watch, which I was sort of confused by, but I think she did it for health reasons, which of course I'm now obsessive on that. And so I think doing an inventory for yourself, and you talk a lot about this in the book in terms of, you know, the you know, writing it down. And I do want you to tell about the letters that you wrote to your kids. So this idea of a self inventory, but also something you want to pass along to your children, that seems important and probably something most people don't do.
And what's true about what you just said, the things that you really value and your shoes and your wine and whatnot, is that that is different from everybody as well, too.
Yeah.
I like good food. You and I can argue about this at a different day, but I don't believe, and a lot of people disagree with me about this, I think there is bad wine and good wine. I don't think there's great wine, at least for my palate. No. It doesn't exist. And so my wine aspirations top out at about $15. But look, that's not a debate, because it's not something that I value, but you do. So great. You should go spend money on wine. I'll spend my money on something else. Everybody's different. You have to try different things in life to figure out what your thing is. And there's probably a lot of things that I spend my money on that you don't value, and that's okay. And so you have to A, try a lot of things, and B, be very careful mimicking other people's desires, assuming that they're going to work for you. That's really important.
So you did write letters to your kids about money.
Right.
Yeah. What's inside these letters?
Yeah. My kids are 6 and 9 years old right now. So, you know,
perfect.
The first of these letters was written almost a decade ago. And, you know, I'm a financial writer, so writing something about finance lessons seemed very apt when my kids were born. And, you know, it's interesting because when I wrote particularly the first one for my son, our first child, I didn't know anything about being a parent. I had no idea. He wasn't even born yet. I wrote it like 2 days before he was born. But I look back on it and I don't think I would change that much. And one of the things that I wrote in there was, you might think you want a flashy car and a flashy watch and a big house, but I'm telling you, you don't. What you want is respect and admiration from other people. And you think that having fancy stuff will bring it. And I still very much, not only do I still agree with that, I think I almost double down on that, that what everybody wants intuitively in their soul is respect and admiration from other people. And there are many ways to get it. You can get it by being a good spouse. You can get it by being a good employee. You can get it by being funny, by being a good friend. But back to what I said earlier, like for a lot of people, the most intuitive lever is material, especially when we live in a world of material abundance, where you can buy a lot of nice things for relatively cheap relative to what they used to be and cost historically. And so it's an easy lever to pull. If only I had a nicer car, people would respect me more. If I had a nicer watch, people would respect me more. I think that's why people want it. And it's not to say that those things don't bring you respect, but I think they bring temporary respect from people you don't really care about. And so if I went out and bought a Rolls Royce, would my wife love me more? No. Would my kids respect me more? No, not whatsoever. And so maybe a couple of people on the street would turn their heads, but the people who I actually want respect from, they couldn't care less. And so there's a great line from Warren Buffett where he says, the definition of success is when the people who you want to love you do love you. Mm-hmm. The people who you want to love you do love you. That's a very different thing from, do I turn heads when I'm driving to the grocery store? And so I think about that a lot of like, the draw towards materialism, I think, can be like a siren song of false hopes. And my message there is not live like a monk. If you like nice cars, if you like nice jewelry, do it. I love nice cars. I love fancy sports cars, but with a reminder to myself that it's not going to bring the attention and admiration that is so intuitive to think that it will. And so that was one of the messages to my kids.
There was about a 5-6 year period where my wife and I got on the circuit in Silicon Valley doing talks. So the improvisation is often kind of popular with our startup culture and other stuff, but we were talking pretty high level things. So I met Jack Dorsey, I met Elon Musk, I met all these characters. And the one thing that I came away from with most of those interactions were, these do not seem like happy people.
Right. Right.
And you know, it's like the studies of lottery winners, like that is not something you think that's going to change everything. And it doesn't. So, and that, I think this has been your experience too. You probably met a billionaire or two.
Yeah, of course. And, I would actually take the over. Not only are they not happy people, I think they are very often, if not exclusively, tortured people, because the reason that they are successful is because probably since the time they were 8 years old and through today, they've woken up every single morning telling themselves, this isn't enough. I can do so much better. I can get more. Now, I always have to make the point, I'm so glad those people exist, because their ambition has created products and innovation that you and I get to benefit from for eternity. Right. That's great. I want to live in a world where people wake up every morning and say, this is not enough. We can do better. But it's true that at the individual level is a detriment to happiness. Of course, like a lot of what happiness and contentment is what happiness is contentment. It's waking up and saying, this is good. I'm all set. I got enough. I'm so happy and grateful for what I have. And I don't feel an overwhelming desire to go get more. I think that's what people assume they're going to have when they get nicer stuff. And so if you imagine your life with the big, nice house, what you're actually imagining is living in a house that you're content with. You actually imagine yourself waking up in the nice house saying, this is all I want. I don't aspire for anything more. And that's what feels good. Like contentment is what feels good. And almost by definition, the richest people in the world are not content. There are a couple of examples here and there of people who got just rich doing their skill, and then they're very happy with it. Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple Computer, gave this talk. It's just last week he said this. He gave away his entire Apple stake, I think decades ago, definitely years ago, if not decades ago. And someone called him out. He's like, I bet you regret doing that, because you'd be worth $100 billion today if you didn't do that. And he was like, absolutely not. He's like, I've had the most incredible life. I've got a good marriage. I've got good kids. I've got good friends. I've given to good causes. And he's like, I've lived such a happy, miraculous life. Never would I stop and say, like, if only I could have had more money, that would have been better. So he's a good example of someone who did become rich, but had a very powerful sense of, this is enough. I'm totally content with what I have here. So there are some examples of that, but most of them, the reason they exist is because they wake up every single day saying, I want more. And I think Warren Buffett is a pretty happy guy. I think Charlie Munger is a pretty happy guy. Jeff Bezos, I think, is a reasonably happy guy. Elon Musk, I think absolutely not. He's talked about this. He's just, I think he wakes up at 2 a.m. if he slept that night with 10,000 voices in his head saying, more, 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 more. Again, I'm glad those people exist. We get cool technology from those people. But there's a difference between admiration and envy. I admire them for what they've built. I don't envy them for the life they live.
It's interesting. There's no real politics in the book, but you can't divorce what this book is talking about and seeing what's playing out on sort of the political cultural stage right now, where a lot of people, you know, with like who want to gild things in gold and, you know, just want power for power's sake. And, you know, it's like, and it's hard sometimes because it's like, oh, is that how winning feels or winning is? I don't think it is. I think we're in for better times eventually, but it's tough right now to watch that when you feel like the values, the ethics, the morals, all those things are out the window.
I agree. I think, you know, it's, you can't study economics and investing and completely divorce yourself from Washington, D.C. I think there's a difference between paying attention to politics versus paying attention to partisanship. Those are very different things. Yep. I'm very interested in policy. I couldn't give two dams about partisanship. And so that's the important distinction. But I think that idea is as old as time, that of trying to get people's attention and covering it in gold and whatever it might be. But there's a difference between, I think this is true for a lot of people this is true, very much true outside of politics. If you are living a flashy material life, you think that other people are jealous of you, but they're not. What they probably are is envious of you. And envy means they hate you. And so gaining your respect by, or what you think is respect, by having other people envying you is a terrible thing. They are now rooting for you to fail. And a lot of people will do this once they get into a higher income bracket. If they're fortunate enough to be making a lot of money, have a high net worth, they will very quickly realize that a lot of their friends and family members are not jealous, they're envious. And they are actually, even if like subconsciously and subtly, rooting for their failure. And so you have to be very careful if you get into that bracket that you are using your good fortune to help you and your family and not looking down upon other people, not judging other people, not making other people feel inferior in their position, because that's always going to come back and bite you. And so there is a quote, I forget which political scientist said this, but it was like, I think the quote was, nothing is more despicable than respect based off of fear. Like if you're getting people to respect you because they fear you or they're envious of you, there's nothing worse than that.
That's interesting. We've been doing a lot of work with, we actually started doing work with the FBI and hostage negotiators, at Quantico. And then that has extended to other work with law enforcement, which is not a place I ever thought I'd end up. But so much of that work is about seeing the other person fully and for they are and dropping all the judgment. There's enough fear to go around. Let's get rid of that. Let's get rid of the shame and just trying to deal with the person in the present, which is why improvisation is helpful to them. But it's also interesting how empathetic it has made these tough guys that we talk to when we deal with the law enforcement. It's really actually kind of lovely to see that they can hold both things. They can be really these tough people who do a tough job who also really feel for other human beings. And that's not a story that often gets told.
I think it's important to look at somebody who is doing something terrible, whatever that crime or inhumanity might be, and say, what you're doing is wrong. You should stop doing it. But given what you've experienced in life, again, as we talked about earlier, all behavior makes sense with enough information. That is not an excuse for atrocious behavior, but it can, even if it's not an excuse, it can help you understand why somebody might do that. There's a great quote from the historian, Will Durant, who said, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, learn enough from history to respect other people's delusions. Like when you see someone who has a deluded belief, respect them for their delusions, because if you lived in their shoes, you'd probably believe the same thing. And by the way, you in your shoes believe things that other people find deluded as well. And so I think that level of empathy, that we're all just kind of products of, if not prisoners of our own past, the country we live in, the generation that we're in, our, you know, our socioeconomic background, we're all shaped by things that are largely outside of our control. And rather, if you see someone you disagree with, rather than saying, why do you do that? A much better question is, what have you experienced that led you to believe that? And if I experience the same thing, would I believe the same thing as you do?
You have some great stories in the book. And the one that I love, because I'd never seen it anywhere else, was about these two sailors. Well, sort of two sailors. One didn't really know how to sail. Can you tell them about these guys?
Yeah. So in 1968, there was a sailing race out of England. It was promoted by the Sunday Times newspaper. And the race was, the first person who can sail around the world solo, nonstop, will win £5,000. And 12 people joined the race. Only one of them finished. Took them over a year to sail around the world nonstop. But there were two sailors who did not finish the race, who had by far the most interesting stories. And I'll go through them kind of quickly. But one was a guy named Donald Crowhurst, who, as you alluded to, had no idea what he was doing. He was at best an amateur sailor. And he made it about halfway down the coast of Africa during this race. He was at sail for about 3 months, and then his boat sprung a leak. And he didn't want to turn around and go home and face shame and humiliation. So he faked the appearance of sailing around the world. He kept radioing home and saying, oh, I'm passing the Horn of Africa. I'm passing, you know, across Madagascar. And I'm sailing around the world. But it was all fake. He was just drifting aimlessly in the middle of the Atlantic. And it eventually caught up with him that this scheme he had of faking his success was not going to work. And the punchline was he ended up killing himself because he didn't want to face shame and humiliation of having failed at this race. Another sailor is a French guy named Bernard Moitessier, who was the exact opposite. He was one of the best sailors in the world. And after 9 months at sea, he was about to win the race legitimately. And he decided that he didn't want to go home and face the commercialization of the press and the media and sponsors and interviews. And what he liked doing was being at sea by himself, being solo. So he quit the race and just kept sailing around the world. And he eventually landed in Tahiti and built himself a house on the beach and lived an awesome life and wrote a book about his experience. But I made this point that, like, Donald Crowhurst wanted nothing else in life than other people's attention and admiration. It was all he wanted. And when he realized he couldn't get it, he killed himself. Yeah. And Bernard Moitessier was the opposite. He was like, he was disgusted at the idea of living a life for the attention of other people. And once he realized that that's what he was doing, he was like, get me out of here as quickly as I can. And so the idea of the internal versus the external benchmark. Are you doing this thing for the external benchmark of other people's attention and approval and applause? Or are you doing it because it actually makes you happy? That is, I think, a model of a lot of what you and I deal with every single day. Do I want this thing? Am I buying this thing because I think it's going to get me attention from other people? Or am I doing it because it's actually going to give me an internal check mark, an internal level of happiness? And I would do this even if nobody was watching. It's a huge part of what happens in today's society.
I don't know where you got the information of David Cassidy's last words were so much wasted time, but that was so sad. That was so
sad, isn't it?
Sad. Right?
That came from his daughter. His daughter confirmed that was his last. And what's interesting about David Cassidy, that was kind of before my generation, but for a lot of people in his heyday, you could not have imagined a more perfect life.
Right.
He was young, successful, famous, admired. And his last words on his deathbed were so much wasted time, which is the worst. It's hard to imagine worse last words than that, of looking back at your life and being like, God, what a failure that was. And so it's, you know, I think that's a good definition of risk, I think, is what you're going to regret on your deathbed. Mm. Now, there could be other definitions, but that's a pretty broad definition of risk. On my deathbed, looking back, what am I going to regret? And a really good life is being in that situation and being like, man, I did the best I could. I made the most of it. I had a lot of mistakes. There's a lot of imperfect periods, but I made the most of it. A really bad level of risk is being on your deathbed and looking back and saying, like, that was my one shot at a life, and I really fumbled the ball here. So I think just as a broad level of risk, that's always been an important anecdote to me.
Dan Pink was on the podcast about his last book, which is about regret, and kind of reframing it as a useful tool. So when you and I've done this after reading the book, which is think about, like, am I going to regret this? And usually we don't regret the things we do. We regret the things that we don't do. You know, like, I didn't go after that thing. I didn't try because I might fail. And in our work at Second City, we use the term risk all the time because it's very risky to go out there without a script. However, like, when you do it and it goes well, nothing feels better. We're afraid, and we're afraid, so we don't do. So what I love about this book is that you are really asking for people to think about and be intentional about their relationship with their money and therefore the relationship they have with their own life that they're living right at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of my own, it's a morbid thing, but I think a lot about the deathbed idea of risk, of looking back and what are you going to regret? And here's one personal example of this. I've been a big saver for my entire adulthood. I've saved the majority of what I made. And some people would look at that and say, Morgan, what about all the vacations you didn't take, all the cars you didn't buy, the house you didn't buy? Don't you regret having saved this much money? The answer is absolutely not. Because if, heaven forbid, I were on my deathbed tonight, I would take so much pleasure knowing that because I've saved, my wife and kids are going to be okay financially. Nothing would make me happy. And nothing would make me feel worse than the reverse. That if I blew it all on a bunch of just conspicuous consumption, and now on my deathbed, I'm like, oh, my wife and kids are screwed. Nothing would make me feel worse. But that might change. I think this will hopefully change. If I'm 90 years old and on my deathbed, and hopefully my kids are stable and on their own back then, by then I probably will look back and say, like, I could have used money as more of a tool to be happier than just hoarding it for my entire life. So I think that definition is going to change throughout the course of your life.
In the section called Try Something New, you talk about finding new books to read, and you say, quote, when finding a new book to read, my strategy is to have a wide funnel and a strong filter. How does that play out in your reading habits?
I do that with reading because if you only read books that you know you're going to like, you are missing 99% of what you will actually like out there. You have to try a million different things. So my reading strategy is if a book title or description is even remotely interesting to me, I will start reading it. And you can do this for free because you can get a Kindle sample for free of any, you can get 10% of any book that's out there for free. There's no excuse not to do this. And so it's a very wide funnel because I'll start reading virtually any book. But I have a very tight filter where if a book is not hooking me right away and I can just tell, like, oh, just the writing style or the argument, this is not going to work for me, I will close it with no remorse and never look back. And so I think a lot of people don't like reading books because they think it's noble to read every book they start to the end. And therefore, they're going to read a lot of books that are not right for them. And they're going to force themselves to the last page. And at the end of it, they're like, that was terrible. I never want to do that again. So I will start reading anything that looks enjoyable, and I will close it without mercy if it's not working. I think that's a good analogy for spending as well. You should try a million different types of spending. You mentioned wine and food and sneakers and whatnot. Try a million things. Try spending more money on food. Try spending a little bit more money on vacations, a little bit more money on clothes in a reasonable way, not going overboard, but then cut it without mercy if it's not working for you.
Right.
Without mercy. Don't tell yourselves, oh, I just didn't buy the right shoes. Maybe if I buy 20 more pairs, then I'll find the right pair. Like, if it's not working for you, go figure out something else. Everybody has their thing, but it's different for every person. And you have to experiment with a different thing because a lot of what society tells you you should want might not be right for you. And so wine is good for you. It's not good for me. No harm, no foul. I tried it. I've tried a lot of very expensive wine, and people have told me, Morgan, this wine is going to blow your mind. And then they hand me something that tastes indistinguishable from $2 chuck to me. I just don't have it. So it doesn't work for me. So no problem. I'll spend my money doing something else. You have to try it, and you have to cut it without mercy if it's not working.
Another great line. This is from Kevin Kelly, who says, quote, tend to the small things. More people are defeated by blisters than mountains.
Right.
That's a good one.
It is a good one. I think most financial mistakes and problems and bad behavior comes not from lack of intelligence. It comes from ignorance. And a lot of people, even if they're higher income people, truly have no idea how much they're spending. They have absolutely no idea how much money is coming in, how much is going out. And the most basic financial advice that I give to people that's so basic and so boring and so kindergarten level is check your bank account every single day. It takes 10 seconds, but so many people are completely ignorant of what's going in and what's going out. And that's when you get those blisters that, so to speak, that Kevin Kelly's talking about.
How about your investments, like the stock market and that sort of thing? Do you check that frequently?
I do. I check it every day. I have for 20 or 25 years, but wow, it doesn't impact my behavior. I check it because I think it's a fascinating window into society of how people think about risk and greed and reward and growth and expectations. I think markets are a fascinating window into how the world works, but it's not like I check it every day and say, oh, I got to buy this. I got to sell that. I've never sold anything in any significant amounts. And so you should check your portfolio as often or as infrequently as it takes to prevent rash decisions. And you don't have to think it's a fascinating window like I do. You don't have to check it every day. But if checking it is causing you to engage in constant activity of buying and selling, then you're probably checking it too often.
Mm. All right. I'm excited about the last question because you don't know what's coming. You were very game to like, no, well, just ask me it at the end. And so thank you for improvising. But it's germane to, I think, what we're talking about. And I'll tell you the story of how we got to the question, which was we did this work at the University of Chicago, and actually Richard Thaler gave us the green light. And we looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. It was called the Second Science Project. Did it for a few years. And we led the scientists through the yes and exercise that we do here at Second City, famous improv exercise. They totally got it. They said there's already science to back up working from a place of abundance. We get that. But what do you do when you don't want to yes and the person? You know, how do you stay inside that conversation? And we didn't know and they didn't know, but we came up with the concept, and the concept is thank you because. So really what's the science of gratitude and the science of wanting to be seen. So you're in a conversation with someone you don't agree with, you thank them for their point of view, and then you just find something of value in what they said. You just want to affirm the value that it's what they believe, and that's fine. And when we run this exercise, people do, we have them debate very banal things, Coke versus Pepsi, beer versus wine, whatever. But what we find when they do the thank you because, that they actually stay in a conversation, learn things about each other. You know, it's a positive move in the right direction. Now, I'm curious for you, in terms of what you're talking about here and the way you see other people, do you have a thank you because moment in your life that that's happened to you?
Yeah, you're right that I had no idea what that question was, but as soon as you say it, the answer is instant and obvious to me, because this is only just a couple weeks ago. My wife and I were having not a fight, but just a debate about something going on in our life. And she said, I always have to remind myself that even when I disagree with you, I know you mean well. Mm. And that was so important to me, because I think a lot of times if someone is disagreeing with them, they instantly view it as a fight, and a fight is just something that you have to win. And when she said that, it was so affirming to me. It made me want to become better at those things, because instantly it was not a fight anymore. If she'd have said, you're wrong about this, and left it at that, instantly inside my head, and I think almost everybody's head, is, oh, this is now a war, and I'm going to win this war through any means available. But when she says, I disagree with you, but I know you mean well, instantly I was like, thank you. Now, how can I try to see your point of view a little bit better?
Yeah,
how can I try to update my view a little bit? It was so great. And I want to extend that to other people more often. I disagree with you, but I know you mean well is a very powerful tool to doing that. So I thank her for giving me that insight just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, very generous. The book is called The Art of Spending Money, Simple Choices for a Richer Life. Morgan, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.